The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. As I mentioned before we went into the news, I've been thinking about baseball a lot this week, mostly because April 15th, 1947 was the year that Jackie Robinson made his debut in the major leagues, the first black player in Major League Baseball. And so I've been thinking about that. I saw a lot of photos of him online, beautiful photos of him this week, celebrating the anniversary of the breaking of the color line. And I decided to pull out some baseball-related interviews we've had on the program over the years. And this first excerpt I'm going to play you is about a book by a guy who has written a lot of them. And it's kind of funny how I met him. I was in Yellow Springs in the Emporium / Underdog Cafe many years ago. And I saw a guy, kind of a distinguished-looking guy, sitting at a table by himself, fiddling around with a laptop computer. And I hadn't seen him around before, and I got curious about him, so I approached him. I'm not as shy as I used to be, and I said, "Hi, what are you doing?" He says, "Oh," he says, "I'm working on a project here." He says, "I'm in town for the Antioch Writers Workshop." He says, "I'm on the faculty this year." His name is Paul Dixon, and I discovered he had written many, many books, all nonfiction, and a lot of them about baseball. We developed a relationship. I've interviewed him a number of times over the years. He's still alive, as far as I know. He's got to be pushing 90. And back in the day, back in 2012, one of the books I interviewed him about was a biography of Bill Veeck. Do you remember Bill Veeck? A few listeners out there probably going, "Oh, yeah, Bill Veeck. I remember that guy." Well, Bill Veeck owned the Cleveland Indians the last time they won the World Series. And when we did this interview, they hadn't won it since, and here we are 13 years later. They still haven't won a World Series since then. Bill Veeck got it done, and he was involved with a lot of teams. Let's listen now to Paul Dixon talking about baseball's greatest maverick, a guy named Bill Veeck, on the Best of the Book Nook.
He grew up in Chicago, and he had baseball really in his blood, didn't he? Because his dad was an executive with the Chicago Cubs. You alluded to the fact that Bill Veeck was the guy who thought of the ivy. And he was a man who really wanted people to have fun, to get them out in the ballpark, to get those crowds coming. And some of the things that he did to encourage that really struck me as just common sense, but they made the experience so much better. Like, one of the first things he looked at was the women's restrooms.
Yeah.
Smart guy.
And his father did that before him. His father looked at the, you know, when he was, his father was president of the Cubs, and his father would look at this ballpark, and he'd see all those straw hats and neckties out there, and he said, "Why don't we get women in here?" So his father was the first one to have ladies' days where women got in free, and then they brought the kids and had to pay for the kids, and then his father was actually the first person to appoint a woman to a front office executive position in baseball, which is pretty radical for when he did it, which was 1928. And then Bill came along and did the same thing. Just kept working on the crowds, and he would, as you said, he would take out the women's restrooms. He'd just rip them out, and some of them would become almost palatial. There was one he built in Chicago that was quite extraordinary. Something you expect to find in Las Vegas or Miami or something. You know, very ornate. And he actually had a contest to name the women's restroom. And actually, there's a scene in the book where this woman actually found the woman who won the contest, and the winning entry was Hall of Femme.
It was all about having fun, wasn't it? And also, he liked to win, too. And one of the things I think that's forgotten about Veeck was that he made winners. I mean, look at the Cleveland Indians. They haven't won anything since.
Right. And the Chicago White Sox, you know, he got the pennant for the White Sox, and he got... And he basically always made them contenders. He never had enough money. In Cleveland, it was almost a miracle, because not only did he do it with some pretty badly damaged guys. There was a guy named Gene Bearden who had the back of his head blown off in the war in a torpedo attack. Was wearing literally went in with a metal plate in his head, and you know he brought in the African Americans, starting with Larry Doby. And again, it was something the other teams just wouldn't, in the American League especially, just would have none of. And he cobbled together these teams. He made money at first ownership in Cleveland. He bought the team in 46. He sells the team in 49, late 49, after the 49 season. And he gives back his owners, which include Bob Hope, the comedian, and other people. He gives them back $20 on the dollar. So he's a good bet.
Uh-huh.
But he always pulls off these amazing. And of course, talent was his. He finds guys out of nowhere. In fact, the second time he's with the White Sox, he brings in a manager. It's a lawyer. He brings in a lawyer to manage the White Sox, and everybody says, "You know, you're crazy. Where did you get this guy? What are you trying to pull off here? You know, this isn't the kind of guy we want to the manager of the White Sox." Well, it was Tony La Russa.
Uh-huh.
He had spotted him, and brought him up. And you know, he had another time between the two ownerships of the White Sox, he had actually thought he was dying. He was so sick, and that's why he sold the White Sox the first time. And he goes down to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. While he's down there, he starts scouting these kids, and he finds this kid in Little League and watches him go through high school. So when he comes back to the White Sox for the second ownership of that team, his first draft choice is a guy named Harold Baines.
Uh-huh.
And nobody's ever heard. He's saying, "Who is? Well, you're wasting your first draft choice on somebody nobody else has ever heard of." Well, Harold Baines is been a wonderful, wonderful player, wonderful pick, wonderful catch. And of course, the Vecchian style was not only did he sort of, you know, watch this kid grow up, Harold Baines, but as soon as he gets him, Vec gets him an agent so he can basically get a better deal from Vec. And then the second thing he does is he gets him a financial advisor because he said, "I don't want to see this young kid, you know, go down that thing where he has all these people leeching his money off from him." So, you know, it was a total package the way he treated people.
I loved what he did with Satchel Paige. Satchel Paige was a star in the Negro Leagues, but he was getting kind of old. But Bill Vec saw that this guy still had a lot of life left in him.
Yeah. And when he did it, of course, when he does it in 1948, Vec really wants the World Series. He wants the World Championship. Satchel Paige is just the guy he needs. And it's almost, there's psychological warfare almost, because all of baseball has been for years saying these guys are no good, they're clowns, they're not up to the caliber of the White Stars. And of course, the minute Paige comes in and starts setting, not only setting records on the ball field and winning, you know, having remarkable results on the field, but he's also packing them in. He's creating new hot, you know, hustle attendance records that single day attendance records would never be broken. Again, that then made a liar out of her. All the guys who'd been saying for years, the old, you know, double rested suit owners who had said that those guys are no good, he made liars out of them. He made fools out of them overnight. And that's why they really were much more resentful of Paige coming out than, say, Jackie Robinson or Larry Doby, who were young guys.
Uh-huh. Here we've got this supposedly washed-up star from the league that was supposedly inferior, and he had the most amazing repertoire of pitches, didn't he?
Unbelievable. And you know, he just has everything. And he's also perfect for Vec, because Larry Doby was introspective and extremely, you know, sort of self-controlled and everything, even though he went through a miserable time, probably in many ways worse than Jackie Robinson in terms of racial hatred that was expressed toward him. But Paige was almost, he was pretty much Vec's equal in terms of being witty and aphoristic and, you know, just, you know, the camera just loved his face and people just followed him around just because he was fun to be around, like Vec was. I mean, they were sort of cut from the same mold.
The book is Bill Vec, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. It was just published by Walker & Company. Paul Dixon wrote it. And, Paul, is this your second book, your third book? I'm just kidding. How many is it, Paul?
Well, it's actually my 64th.
That's why I call you the Vesuvius of books, Mr. Dixon.
Well, that sounds like there's no control if it was the Vesuvius.
64 books.
Yeah, but some of them are little goofy things.
How many of those were about baseball?
Well, I say I've done 11 bat and ball books because I did one book on softball.
Oh.
I think it's the only serious book ever written on softball and its history and why it's important and, you know, that whole business. But so I've done a bunch on baseball. And this is my first biography, though. I decided I was 68 years. I'm 72 now. So I was 68, 67, 68. I decided I want to teach myself how to do a biography, which is a different, it's a totally different set of muscles than you'd use to say, even do a historic narrative, because you've got, there's so many other more variables in a biography, because if somebody said it was like holding a bird in your hand. If you're too tough, if you're too constrictive, if you're too demanding of your subject, you end up killing the bird. And if you're too loose with it, if you let them get away with things and you look the other way when they're bad, the bird flies away. You lose the bird. And the trick is to basically bring the bird from, you know, carry it in your hand the whole time you're doing the biography. And then, you know, it becomes your bird in the sense that he becomes your creation. It's like, you know, the other thing when you start doing biography, you think that if you took 10 Pulitzer Prize-winning biographers and said to them, all right, you 10, each of you using primary sources, do a biography of Ben Franklin or Babe Ruth or somebody, you'd get 10 different Ben Franklins or 10 different Babe Ruths, because you'd have everybody, you know, they'd be seeing it from different standpoint. And once you get into primary sources, I mean, one of the things I got for Vec, I got his FBI files, I got his military service record, and these things took, each of those things took, it was the same year, but they took about a year to get each of those things. And once you really get into the source material, you know, you have it, the game changes. It's not just the guy sitting down with a box full of newspaper clippings. You're actually working with things that he may not even know. You know, in his FBI files, there were probably things that he didn't even know, which is really true. That really makes it most, in a lot of ways, is one of the most appealing things a writer can do, because it forces you into somebody else's skin for a couple of years, or at least part of the day, into somebody else's skin.
Well, it's been fun for me out here on the periphery to observe as this book went from an idea to a completed book here in my hand. And your list of acknowledgments at the end, I guess I have to utter a disclaimer here, because you have my name in there, and I really appreciate that. I'm trying to remember what I did.
You did a couple omnibus, search, and you actually found me a lead.
Okay, I think maybe it was something to do with Mike Vec.
Yeah, but it was also, I think you also found some guy. You put something in your blog, and somebody contacted me. So you were part of my wide antenna system.
That's right. I remember now.
That was Paul Dixon on the Best of the Book Nook, as we're doing some baseball interviews today on the program. And that particular interview, I'd forgotten until I listened to that again, that he had included my name in the acknowledgments for his biography of Bill Vec, baseball's greatest maverick. I totally forgot about that, and I really did not deserve a credit from him, but he's a super nice guy, and I really appreciated it. I was thrilled, actually. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. And I met Bill Vec. I should say I met Paul Dixon. I met Bill Vec through Paul Dixon, and I met Paul at the Emporium in Yellow Springs many years ago when he was in town for the Antioch Writers Workshop. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook and more baseball right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, dipping into our archive of baseball-related interviews. And I've done a few of them over the years. In fact, I interviewed a couple of key figures in the Big Red Machine, some guy named Pete Rose and another guy named Sparky Anderson, but we're not playing those interviews today. We're playing others. There's a few of them in the archive. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been thinking about baseball because this week we had the anniversary of the breaking of the color line in Major League Baseball. April 15, 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first Major League Baseball player who was black. And if you listen to that interview I did, that excerpt with Paul Dixon a few minutes ago, he mentioned the guy who broke the color line in the American League, and Bill Veeck was a big part of that. And that was Larry Doby. And he also talked about Satchel Paige, who had a late career burst there for the Cleveland Indians. Up next, we're going to talk about the St. Louis Cardinals and one of their great players. I always wanted to interview the New York Times sports writer George Vesey. I only did one interview with him. It was back in 2011 when Stan Musial was still living, and he had just published a biography called Stan Musial, An American Life. Let's listen.
When Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues in 1947, while Musial was hardly an activist or a speechmaker, you know, he's exactly the opposite, but people would say to him, how do you feel about Robinson? And Musial would say, I played with those guys in high school. They were my teammates. And they had a history. They had once walked out of a hotel in, I want to say, Pittsburgh during a state basketball tournament because the hotel was messing around with, you know, hiding them from, you know, from view and all that. And they just walked out and went to another hotel. So that's where Musial got his very quiet, unspoken sense of fairness that he lived up to in 1947.
George Vesey joins us. He's written Stan Musial, An American Life. Recently, I had the opportunity to interview Jimmy Breslin for his Branch Rickey biography. And reading through that, obviously it was a short biography, but I don't remember any mention of Stan Musial in that book because obviously it's about Jackie Robinson primarily.
Right.
But Branch Rickey was a key figure in Musial's background too.
He was, in the sense that he ran that farm system, which just signed up all these poor kids, and in those days, under Rickey, it was all poor white kids, and they just signed everybody that needed a dollar to their name and would go off and play somewhere. And Musial was one of those guys. They sent him to West Virginia for a few years, and then somewhere else. And he was having moderate success as a wild left-handed pitcher. And it wasn't until he had a tremendous spring in Springfield, Missouri, that Rickey showed up. And ever after, Rickey could tell the story, and I've seen it on tape, of Rickey giving an interview in the early 60s before he passed, of Rickey saying, well, we had our eye on the boy, and we knew, and I went, and it is true, he did go down to Springfield to scout Musial, but in reality, there were so many other people who were the offshoots of Rickey. In other words, Rickey had all these scouts and managers out there, so it was his system, but he wasn't exactly the fairy godfather of Stan Musial.
It's hard to imagine Stan Musial in any other uniform besides the St. Louis Cardinal uniform, but early on, before he really became a Cardinal, he had a little bit of doubt about being with that team, didn't he?
Well, right. He had heard the Cardinals had been penalized for signing a bunch of players illegally and signing up. They would sign up entire leagues sometimes. Rickey was a pretty devious guy for all his Bible spouting. And he would sign up things he weren't supposed to do. So the commissioner of baseball, who couldn't stand him, Commissioner Landis, he went after Rickey and let loose a lot of players, including a very good St. Louis boy named Pete Reiser, who wound up with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Musial heard about this, and I guess he was having second thoughts. And then a friend of his in this little mill town in western Pennsylvania took him up to what might have been his first or second visit to Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. And Musial got the bug of playing with his hometown team. And he made, well, I can't say it was a mistake. He was honest. He told somebody, I think it was Pye Traynor, the coach of the Pirates. He said, you know, I have actually signed a contract with the Cardinals. And Traynor at that point turned to him and said, Branch Rickey never lets anybody get away. You know, son, you're going to get called to the Cardinal farm system, which is what happened a few weeks later. But, yes, he did have second thoughts. And in fact, even when he first broke in, there were talk that first started to have success, that the Yankees were looking at him and the Giants and, you know, teams that had a little bit of money were looking at him. But by that time, Rickey would not let him get away.
You take us back to 1941, the year that Pearl Harbor was bombed and that we have these great players who have their careers disrupted by wartime service. You've got Joe DiMaggio with the Yankees. You've got right. Ted Williams with the Red Sox. And then you've got this little rookie in St. Louis. And he was the quiet one, wasn't he?
He certainly was. And it was his personality. He had trained himself to be not particularly noticeable. He was uncomfortable speaking in public, and he was a little bit shy and bashful in his own way, although certainly a fine fellow and a great teammate. People loved him. But he managed to get into baseball, to stay into baseball, while DiMaggio and Williams were going off to war. The only year that he was away was 1945, and there are reasons for it. He was a sole support of his parents. His father was ill by then, and he and his wife had married young and had two children by that point. And so he was the sole support of a family. I'm sorry, he had one child. So he was a sole support of a family. And he didn't enlist, but that area had so many men going into the service from those mill towns that the draft board had no problem at all with deferring somebody with an ill family.
And Stan Musial originally thought he was going to be a pitcher, didn't he?
He was. He thought he was a he couldn't understand why they signed him as a pitcher. I mean, he was a pretty good pitcher as a kid. He won a lot of games in high school, but he was not a phenom either, and he was pretty wild. One scout or manager wrote a report in this very well-organized farm system of Ricky, and the report said, "This is the most puzzling, wildest pitcher I've ever seen." And, you know, for a grunt lifetime manager, that was quite a statement. But Musial's record was, you know, lots of walks, and then he hurt his arm. He was playing the outfield because he could hit. The manager in Daytona Beach, Florida, used him in the outfield, and Musial was making a diving catch in the outfield and hurt his shoulder. And pretty much then he knew that he was not the same pitcher, that he never was going to make it, and that the Cardinals didn't bring him in for arm surgery the way you would nowadays with a prospect. So by the end of his third year, he pretty much knew that he was going to have to make it as a hitter.
And Stan Musial went on to be one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, but he wasn't in a big media center, was he?
Well, you know, St. Louis was certainly bigger in those days. I mean, it was a top 10 city in population when he came up in 1940, in that decade, and it has been sliding ever since. I mean, right out of the top 50 or 60, I mean, all the Sun Belt and so on. But St. Louis was the gateway, and it was a big-time city in a lot of ways that people paid attention to. It wasn't the media city that New York was, but on the other hand, there was pretty much only New York and Chicago, and, you know, the West Coast wasn't even that big in those days if you looked at it, and there wasn't all the internet and the television and so on. So St. Louis was proportionally a lot more important, and people in St. Louis, and I have to say this, I love the city, I've been going there for a long, long time. They have worked up this feeling that Musial was ignored because he was a God-fearing Midwesterner and people in the East don't like that kind of guy. Musial was a prince in New York. He came to New York as a visiting player. He was royalty. Dodger fans loved him. I mean, I don't say they cheered every hit he got, but they loved him. And when he was staying in New York, he knew the restaurants. He and Red Shandings would go out at night. They'd go to a Broadway play. They knew actors. They hung out in places. I mean, they were hardly bumpkins. And he was lionized in New York. So it wasn't that Musial suffered because, in fact, there were two or three papers in St. Louis in those days, and he certainly was lionized there. But in New York, the columnists, the big-time columnists, the Joe Williams, the Red Smiths, the Arthur Dailies, they wrote about Jimmy Cannon. They wrote about him all the time. They'd go to spring training, and, you know, Williams would cuss at them, and DiMaggio would sulk. And there was nice guy Stan Musial, and he'd sit, and in his own, you know, not particularly eloquent way, he would chat. And let me tell you, as I've come to realize as a sports columnist, we're pretty easy. You know, we're pretty charmed by somebody that'll sit there and say, "Hey, fellas, how you doing?" and talk to you for half an hour and give you your column so you can go to the pool.
And then you had Ted Williams, who loved the press.
Well, yeah, the knights of the keyboard. I mean, Williams was a grump in those days. I got to see him as an older man, and he was pretty charismatic. I mean, the guy that I saw as a manager in the 60s and then as an icon in later years, I mean, he was pretty charismatic guy. It was a pleasure to be around. He had all kinds of theories, and I interviewed him a month or six before he died, and it was pretty sad to see. But he was a different person. I mean, back then he was a tormented soul. The interesting thing that I bring out in the book, and I guess I'd never realized it so much, was all three of them, the what I call the big three, had ethnic drive and background. Williams, which I'd never realized, and nobody ever made anything of this, his mother was Mexican.
Uh-huh.
Mexican background.
Uh-huh.
And not only was she a Salvation Army lady out all day, you know, saving souls in San Diego, but she had a Mexican background. And I think that led to Williams being a, you know, pretty fair man, particularly toward the Negro League players when they got into baseball. I mean, he was certainly more liberal than the team he played for in that sense. DiMaggio came, you know, his family was from Sicily. They were fishermen. He had a pretty strong sense of distrust of management and leadership, as well he should have, since the Yankee management tried to exploit him and used the New York press to call him unpatriotic and selfish and all of this. And then there was Muzio, coming from a Polish father and a mother of, you know, sort of Hungarian/Czech background, and hearing Polish spoken in the household, and all these other ethnic groups in Donora, Pennsylvania. All three of them came from a very strongly ethnic point of view. The book, the subtitle of it is Stan Musial, An American Life, A-N, American Life, and it's a very apt subtitle that somebody else came up for me, and it really tells the story, that this is a kid that saw deprivation, saw his father marching downhill every day to work in these pretty horrendous steel and zinc mills, coming back, you know, sort of beat up by the process. I got taken around Donora by an old pal of Musial's, a man about 80 named Bimbo Ciccone, who played tailback for Pitt and, you know, was an icon at Pittsburgh. And Bimbo was talking about working in the summer in the steel mills. You know, he's young enough and sharp enough to remember what it was like to work in the steel mills, and that's what Musial faced if he couldn't hit.
He was the one who remembered Stan's dad walking down the street tossing a baseball up in the air.
That's very true. The father, yeah, as an immigrant, did not have much feel for baseball. There's a whole story, you know, you can hear different layers of it, but the essentially the father did not want the boy to sign a baseball contract. He didn't understand that. The story that's been told by the family is that the father wanted the son to go to college. Other people say, no, the father wanted him to work in the steel mill. Mm-hmm. So in between, Musio wound up getting his way because the mother stood up for him, and you know, I guess he did himself. But the father came to appreciate baseball when the son made it to the major leagues. And in 1942, the father and mother were brought to New York for the World Series, games 3, 4, and 5 against the Yankees. And at that point, the father thought it was pretty cool. And you can certainly see it from his point of view, you know, coming from Poland and not understanding the culture and being very much an outsider, you know, a greenhorn in the classic American sense. All of a sudden, people are fussing over him because he's the father of the St. Louis Cardinals' great young hitter.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was the longtime New York Times sports writer George Vesey talking about his biography of Stan Musial. Stan Musial, An American Life. And I loved it that he pointed out that those three great players from the 1940s, the greatest hitters of the period, were all children of immigrants. Ted Williams, his mother was of Mexican descent. Stan Musial's dad was Polish. His mother was of Hungarian descent. And, of course, Joe DiMaggio, of Sicilian descent. And they all became American heroes. Ancestors from other countries. And they played great baseball. They were great hitters. Of course, I think Ted Williams was the greatest hitter ever, but I'm a little biased in that regard. And we have one more baseball-related interview excerpt coming up on the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. This morning, I've been featuring baseball-related interviews from our archive. And I began the program with an excerpt from an interview with Paul Dixon, recorded back in 2012, when he talked about his biography of Bill Veeck, baseball's greatest maverick. As I mentioned before, I met Paul one day in Yellow Springs. He was in town for the Antioch Raiders workshop, and this was the beginning of a beautiful relationship. We did a number of interviews over the years. I haven't talked to him in a while, but we probably did a half dozen interviews. He writes widely about many topics, but in particular baseball. And he's probably most well-known, or should we say most notorious, for writing an amazing reference work called the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. And they just put out a third edition of it back in 2011. And I talked to him about it. Let's listen.
What is it about baseball that makes it so compelling? We have these very interesting characters and this amazing language in baseball. What is it about baseball?
I think there are a whole lot of factors that made it. I think, for one thing, it really sort of fits the rhythm of American life. And it's been with us for a long time. I mean, it really parallels the growing season. You know, it starts in the spring when the seeds are going in the ground, and it takes you through the harvest and the fall, and it sort of captures the rhythm of the summer. And, you know, in the 19th century, I think it was carried very much by the newspapers. The telegraphy, you could send a box score as a telegraph message very efficiently from one coast to the other. And so people on one coast the next morning could read, could sort of decipher a whole game that was played on the other coast the night before. You couldn't do that with prose. You couldn't do that with any other way. So you had and then of course the newspaper writers got better and better and better. And sometimes the best writers on the paper were writing about baseball. And then you get into the 20th century, and you get in the 20s, and along comes radio, and radio then becomes tremendously important. And whole networks are founded. For example, the St. Louis Cardinals had a network of stations going down deep into Texas and Oklahoma, and then, you know, north, east, west, and south. And the Red Sox had this universe that extended up to the tip of Maine. And you know, so you had these wonderful announcers filling 2 hours, 2.5 hours of prose, many of whom were sort of born storytellers, and many of them had a southern or a rural cant to what their presentation, which made it all the more appealing and rhythmic. So I think all these things fed. And I think the other thing is the 20th century developed. We got a series of sort of operatic characters, I mean, bigger than life, you know, starting with Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and going through Dizzy Dean and Satchel Paige and Yogi Berra. And as I flash these names across the radio dial here, you get an image of these guys immediately. Not, you know, Bill Veeck's one of them, and Leota Rocher, and out through DiMaggio and then Mantle. But you had these very different personalities. They all seemed bigger than maybe they really were. But we really knew them as characters, and they almost all of them were wonderful. The ones that I mentioned often, you know, gave great quotes and great interviews, and sort of created news on their own. I mean, when Marilyn Monroe marries Joe DiMaggio, that's sort of like every baseball kid's dream. You
know? Paul Dixon joins us. The Dixon Baseball Dictionary, which just came out in paperback, the third edition, is a veritable treasure trove of baseball lore, baseball language, some amazing photos. And it's really interesting to me to see how language keeps changing in baseball and how certain terms that were once in vogue are no longer around, and we keep coining new terms. In fact, one term that used to be much more common back when they played a lot more daytime baseball was the term grandmother. Like, my grandmother died.
Oh, I see. I didn't even get the context. Oh, yeah. That was, you know, the time of the World Series and stuff, and you wanted off from work, and so you'd say, my grandmother died. Yeah, there was that. And back then, I mean, back in day radio, you used to have a 12 o'clock hitter who was great in batting practice, but when the game came around at 1 o'clock, he couldn't do anything. And now that's a 6 o'clock hitter. you know, he's great in BP, but he's no good after that. But yeah, but the grandmother thing, I mean, I remember as a kid that was just, you know, Bob Hope would get on the radio and say, you know, a lot of grandmothers are going to die next week. The World Series is starting. And then your joke was you'd go to your boss and said, I can't work tomorrow. My grandmother died.
There's a lot of language tied to particular franchises, too. I know you're a Baltimore Oriole fan, and we've got the Baltimore Farewell, the Baltimore Chop, the Baltimore Bounce, the Baltimore Dinger. And one of my favorites came out of Baltimore, and it's the Weaver Doctrine. And that's something to do with cleaning home plate, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was really, you know, you've got it right in front of you. You can...
I don't have it open to that page. I just wrote some notes.
Yeah.
And the Weaver Doctrine was sort of a doctrine about Earl Weaver, the former manager of the Orioles. And it was something about don't go up and start kicking the dirt off the plate while you're arguing with the umpire.
Yeah.
Then we have the monster. And when I think of the monster, I think of the green monster, the wall in Fenway Park. But it actually relates to Bill Veeck, doesn't it? Wasn't that his exploding scoreboard?
Yeah, that's what the other people called it. But he had that was one of his great innovations with it, was the exploding scoreboard in Chicago. And he took great delight in it. Veeck always wanted to make fireworks a big part of baseball, so that was one that he brought in. You know, sometimes, Veeck, I hate to tell you this, but sometimes I balk for a second, a good baseball term, I balk for a second because there are 10,000 words in the book, and sometimes the meat computer isn't as fast as it should be.
But you don't have them memorized?
No.
Okay, well, let's just chat about a few of them. And so many of these I'd never heard of. Like, it was before my time when Huey Jennings, the Tiger manager, used to go, "Eah!" What was that about?
That was just sort of his signature at first base, and he used it to distract other players, and there were various protests. But it was just this call. It was very much a part of the lore of baseball at that time. And he raised one of his feet up, and he'd raise his arms, and he'd go, "Eon." So that was just one of those bits of baseball folklore that still is with us.
And there's so many pieces of language that relate to hits and pitches. And you've got the cloud buster, the cloud hunter, the cloud scraper, the cloud searcher, the wigwag, the wigwagger, the bingler, bingling, bingles. I love this stuff. It's so colorful. You had, what was it, the sackalodger?
Sockalodger, yeah. I mean, but you know, and these things keep coming. I mean, I even after this book, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I got a note from a guy who was talking to a scout, and the scout said, and this is the kind of thing that's constantly happening in baseball, but he said that he had just heard a new term, which was hard 90. And hard 90 was a scout's term for a guy that really put on the, you know, major effort running from the batter's box to first base. Even if he'd hit a grounder, even if he hit a pop fly, he would run that way because there was one chance in 200 or whatever it was that the ball would be dropped or bobbled. And apparently in a scouting report, somebody says he runs the hard 90 means that this guy's really a hustler. And so, you know, you're always reinventing these terms. You know, the whole business of that blooping ball that goes in the outfield, I mean, it's always been called something like a dying quail, and then around the turn of the century it became a Texas leaguer because one of the teams in the Texas League, the owner claimed his players could drop those balls between those looping sort of balls and drop them in between the outfielders at will. And then they came up with Texas leaguer, and then, of course, can of corn, which was an allusion to the old grocery store where the grocer would use this long hook and he just sort of pull the can of corn down, or any can, down off the top shelf, and it would tumble down and he'd stretch out his apron and catch it in the apron. And that, you know, that was sort of for this lazy looping fly ball. But the other day I was on a radio show and somebody called up and said, well, when they were growing up it was called a Dairy Queen because it was sort of a soft serve.
So the opposite of a hard 90, would that be drag a piano?
That would be drag a piano, yes.
And another term for a Texas leaguer might be can't teach that?
Yep.
Because a flare that drops?
Yep, yeah, you can't teach that.
I love that.
Yeah, and you mentioned Baltimore Chop. That was another one of my favorites. That was when the old Baltimore Orioles the ones that became eventually the New York Highlanders and then the Yankees, those guys, they claimed they could, they kept the dirt packed very tightly in front of the pitcher's mound, and they claimed that they could chop down on the ball and cause it to bounce right over the pitcher's head and, you know, hit that hard bounce. And later on, Casey Stengel had his players rehearse that as the Yankees, and he called it the butcher boy chop. But you sort of needed a hard, you couldn't be doing it with a soggy infield.
The old manicured infield that has cost so many teams. Paul Dixon joins us. We're talking about the Dixon Baseball Dictionary, which just came out in paperback in the third edition, and also his recent collection called Baseball Is, Defining the National Pastime. And when that pitcher, that hurler, that hurlster, that hurlsmith throws a pitch with nothing on it, would you call it a nudist pitch or is a Lady Godiva pitch more?
It could be, it could, or as Tug McGraw would say, a Peggy Lee fastball. Is that all there is?
And then there's all those distractions. Like, I wasn't aware that Dazzy Vance used to use the fluttering cuff so effectively.
Oh, that was, sure. Yeah, that was a way of getting, sort of confusing the batter. And you still have that stuff. I mean, one of the things that amazes me is the stuff just keeps coming in. I mean, the recent one, you know, just, again, I think either to way back or way forward, but there's a new term that's everywhere all of a sudden, is pie thrower.
Oh.
And for a pitcher that seems to, rather than truly throw the ball, he sort of pushes it out with his hand. And it's an illusion, not a reality. I mean, he really is still throwing it, but it's just the way he appears out there. And then a lot of this is based on illusion. Like, one of the ones I like in the book is the Bugs Bunny changeup, which was a term that came out after in the, I guess, about 2002, 2003. And certain writers would start to believe, and some of the ballplayers, that certain pitchers could throw a pitch that appeared to slow down or almost stop just as it got to the batter's box, thus throwing off the batter's timing. And that became it was used to describe certain pitches, and it alludes back to the famous Bugs Bunny cartoon from the late 40s, in which Bugs strikes out a whole side by throwing one pitch, and it stops, and these monster guys keep getting up and swinging at it, and they can't hit it because it's just outside their reach. And so that stuff's coming all the time, and a lot of it's very colorful.
And if they could actually hit the Bugs Bunny pitch, they might hit a bug on the rug.
That's right. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this book, I started working on it in 85 when I was at a ball game in Baltimore with my kids. And they were their young kids then, little boys who are now, you know, grown up men who make, you know, take care of themselves and have grandchildren and all the rest. But one of the things is they were at the game and they kept saying to me, well, why do they say umpire and baseball and every other sport it's a referee? Or why do they say, why is this a clubhouse, but if they were playing football, it would be a locker room? They were going through all this sort of things that little kids go through. Or, you know, why is he a shortstop? He's not that short, you know, that kind of thing. And I said I'd go back and look it all up in the library the next day. And I get to the library and there's no such book. And as a writer, you're always looking for to use a football metaphor, you're always looking for that hole in the line where you can run for a touchdown. You're looking, if you're doing reference, especially, you're looking for a perennial. And I saw this, you know, this hole in the line, and I started recruiting people. And I had the first edition out in 89. Then the second in 99, and now this edition. And what's interesting was the number of people I recruited along the way or came to me to help. So I have about over 250 people who have made substantial contributions to the book.
And that was Paul Dixon talking about his monumental baseball dictionary, the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. His publisher wanted to name it after the publishing house, but that would have been so wrong. And if you're into baseball, or you know someone that is, what an amazing reference work that is. I would suggest
you turn people onto it if they're not aware of it and they're into baseball, because they would be thrilled to check it out. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And I was inspired in part to do that baseball-related program today because we just had an anniversary on April 15th. Going back to 1947, when baseball's color line was broken with Jackie Robinson joining the Brooklyn Dodgers. And this week we also had a memorial service in Dayton. And that was at the Woodland Cemetery Mausoleum Chapel. It was a service for a former colleague of mine here at WYSO. When I came to the station in June of 1993, we were still in the Antioch College Student Union in kind of a different environment there. And one of the DJs, one of the many music DJs I met in what was still a very much a community radio station at that time, was a guy named Ken Catawick. And Ken had been hosting jazz shows on WYSO for years. And I saw his obituary in the paper, and I know that WYSO was a very important part of Ken's life. And so I thought that out there in jazz heaven, Ken would appreciate being remembered on WYSO. This is from his obituary, which was just in the Dayton Daily News. Kenneth E. Catawick has left this earthly plane to live among the stars he loves so much. He was born on April 1st, 1948, and graduated from Fairmont East High School and Wright State University. Ken retired from working for the Montgomery County Department of Jobs and Family Services after decades of service. Many people knew him as the host of WYSO's Straight No Chaser every Sunday morning for 27 years, playing the latest and the quirkiest in jazz. He was a devoted and hands-on parent to his only child, Emily, and could be seen at every one of her skating or musical performances. Ken especially enjoyed being a part of the Centerville Jazz Band family for Emily's high school years, serving as photographer and chaperone. He loved Emily, his many cats, photography, astronomy, jazz, and friends and family. And the family suggests that one of the charities that you might want to support in remembering Ken in the obituary is WYSO 91.3 FM. And Ken hasn't been on the air here in years, and obviously WYSO was very important to him. And Ken, remembering you as we close out this program today, we connected on a couple of similar subjects. He loved cats, and so do I, and he loved jazz, and so do I. And he used to do his show. When I came to the station, he had an evening show. He was one of the alternate takes hosts, and he had a recording of a cat, and it would sound like he was squeezing the cat, and he would throw that in there. And he liked to call himself the jazz doctor. And when his daughter, Emily, would have a birthday, he would bring her into the station, and he would let her be the programmer. So people that would tune in on Emily's birthday expecting Ken to host a jazz show would be astonished when they would hear Nurse Emily, as he called her on the air, hosting the show and playing music that she wanted to play, and none of it was jazz. Those were different days. So if you tuned in and you're expected to hear jazz, suddenly you'd hear Emily's favorite singer. I think she was 11 or 12 years old when she was doing this. And it's pretty funny to listen to. Those were different days. This is a long time ago. This is back in the 90s. And wow, thanks, Ken. Thanks for the memories and the humor. He always brought a lot of humor to his program, and he had a very distinctive style on the air when he hosted jazz, and he knew the music. He really did. He was a big fan of Sun Ra. Big fan. If you don't know who Sun Ra was, look him up. He was out of this world. He was from outer space, and Ken really related to that with his interest in astronomy and the stars. Closing out the program today on the Best of the Book Nook, remembering Ken Catawick. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening. and have a great weekend.